Moses, well, we just did a whole thing for 10 chapters of Exodus, right? Or 20 of Exodus. So, not Moses. Mother of Moses? No, we don't know anything about her. Just her name. We're talking about a lady named Miriam. And that's who I want to focus on. Who is Miriam? Sister of Moses, a.k.a. Moses' sister. Both answers I'll take as correct because it's the same thing. Well, yeah, technically she's related to Aaron as well, but he's not the superstar that Moses was, right? I talked about how we went through Exodus, and Moses, he is an interesting bird to say the least. He's got some unique characteristics. He's got some unique experiences. He's got a perspective and a situation which is unique in the Old Testament. So we know a lot about him because he wrote the books that we've been in for the past couple of months, most of them anyway. And so he's a unique individual. But his siblings, Aaron, we know a decent amount. We know what he was originally designed to do in helping Moses. He was kind of a statesman. He was a spokesman for him. Moses would speak on behalf of God, and then Aaron would seems to be speaking on behalf of Moses. That seems to be what took place, although we noticed as we were going through Exodus that oftentimes it's not said that Aaron was the one doing the speaking, but it says Moses said. So maybe Moses just needed a guy behind him to kind of back him up in speaking, and he launched out there and did it himself. Or maybe the whole time through, Moses doing things is actually Moses doing it through Aaron. That could be the case. Or it could be a combination of either or as it blends through his work. But whatever the case, we know a decent amount about Aaron. And there is a lot of information that we can pull out about him. And we could stay on that for a couple of weeks. And that's not the intention. So Miriam, I think, though, within four different distinct passages, gives us enough information about her to have us pose some questions that we don't have answers to, which is, of course, our favorite way to study the Bible. It's intriguing to us. We want to know more. There's nothing more there about that particular topic, and so we're stuck. And we'll eventually get to the end and say, well, if we get to heaven and we still have questions about it, we can just ask her if she's there, right? That's kind of how we normally deal with things that we're not knowing a whole lot about. Whatever the case, we're looking at Miriam. So the first instance that we have her mentioned here, and there will be some who say we don't know it's Miriam for sure, but it makes a lot of sense in the text. As we're looking at Exodus chapter 2, and we look in verse 1. And a man of the house of Levi went and took as a wife a daughter of Levi. Okay, that's a good start. So the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him for 3 months. Now, I had a 3-month-old at one point in time. I've got a 5.5-month-old now. I don't know how you hide a 3-month-old from people that are looking for it. I really don't know. But anyway. But when she could know... Well, I mean... I don't know. I think every mother looking at her child says, this is the most beautiful child I've ever seen, which everybody's wrong except for my wife. So anyway, when she could no longer hide him, she built an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, laid it in the reeds by the riverbank, as one would normally do. We've been through this text before, so I'm saying it completely tongue-in-cheek. If you're the first time here with us, I have a somewhat unique way of reading and experiencing this in my mind. So we've already been through this text before, so take it with a grain of salt how I say it. Verse 4, and his sister. So the first time we have mention of a sibling for this beautiful child who's going to be named Moses. It's interesting because when you look at verse 2 and verse 3, it somewhat implies that the emphasis is on the mother seeing this beautiful child, wanting to hide him away, and there's no information given to us thus far about there being any relatives, any more siblings. So it's not her first child, obviously, in verse 2, right? So his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. So she's kind of got a bird's eye view on the situation. This baby is not just hanging out in an ark made of bulrushes in the reeds by the water with no one supervising. She's currently present, which, of course, is significant. Verse 5. And then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river. It's almost like they knew she would be there. And her maidens walked along the riverside, and when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. And when she opened it, so there was some kind of enclosure, it appears, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept, as a three-month-old would normally do, or three, four, five-month-old would normally do. So she had compassion on him. Interesting choice of words there for her. And said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." So something about the physical characteristics of the child gave it away. There was no doubt a distinction in physical features between someone who was from Egypt and someone who was a Hebrew or from the stock of Abraham. There would have been some intermarrying going on, but at this point in time, there was still that obvious distinction, it seems. Verse 7. And then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, so they have a connection already. This is a random person walking up, it seems. "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Stroke of genius, how all of this just happened to line up almost as if it was planned beforehand, right? Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. Talk about a plan that was executed with perfection. Here is a mother who is afraid of losing this child, concocts a plan to be able to save this child's life by having Pharaoh's daughter essentially adopt this child and then paying the actual mother to nurse her baby for Pharaoh's daughter. So not only is the baby's life saved, which is, of course, mission number one, but also mission number two, she gets paid for being a mother, which is great. I mean, what more can you ask for? And then you've got the third one here. This baby Moses gets to grow up in Pharaoh's household with wealth and education and so on, in a place of privilege compared to everyone else of his brethren being in slavery. So interesting situation, to say the least. But we introduce our individual Miriam here as the girl who oversaw this plan, and it was successful. So again, there are some who say, well, you don't have any proof that it's actually Miriam. It just says his sister. But considering that we always learn after this point that it seems to be just the three of them, Aaron, Moses, and Miriam, it would make logical sense unless there's some unnamed sister here who's never mentioned by name again. So, any questions, comments, additions, problems, whatever, with this text? Okay, we've been through this text not too long ago, so I know it's not surprising to many of you, so I wanted to introduce it there. And then let's go over to the second passage in which we find this individual Miriam discussed in Exodus chapter 15. This one is a bit smaller, to be fair, but she is mentioned, so it's good for us to go over. Verse 20. So in chapter 14, in the previous context, you have a somewhat significant event in the history of the Hebrews. What was that event? What big thing just happened? Crossing the Red Sea, right? They had a miracle performed by God that allowed this entire nation to walk through the middle of the Red Sea, a wall of water on the left, a wall of water on the right, backwards. And then you had the cloud that was above them as a figure of speech of them going through, being immersed, if you will, in that water, unto or in the name of Moses by his authority and power that God gave him. A figure of what would happen through Christ in the future. And so the Red Sea crossing was a significant event for many reasons. It had literal implications of them being redeemed by God. God wanted them to be saved, and therefore he performed a miracle, a thing that's outside of the natural realm of possibility to be able to provide that redemption for his people. And now they're rejoicing because they were given the victory, right? They escaped their enemies. Their enemies were all swallowed up by that sea and drowned. They were now free and clear to go about their way, being led by God to the promised land. Great stuff. But there is a moment here in which Moses not only has a visual and a vocal reaction to the salvation, in which he has a song of praise to God for this. It's a great moment. But also Miriam is mentioned to us once again. So in verse 19 for context. For the horses of Pharaoh went with his chariots and his horsemen into the sea, and the Lord brought back the waters of the sea upon them, but the people of Israel went on dry land in the midst of the sea. Showing the distinction between this was not just a normal occurrence. You had the entire Egyptian chariots and army and so on going through this same passage that God allowed them to die when he saved the people. So, interesting connection there. And then verse 20. And then Miriam, the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took the timbrel in her hand. We'll just pause right there and make a few small comments. She's introduced to us here by name, which shows that she's somewhat significant to this account. Otherwise, she'd just be some unnamed prophetess that was among them. Then Miriam, and then her job is described here as being the prophetess. What is a prophetess? Okay, receiving revelations from God. Sometimes it's just forth knowledge, meaning they were given the word of God to tell forth to the world. Sometimes it was foreknowledge, we sometimes say, given information about the future to reveal, to prove that God's message was actually true. What did you say it was, Larry?
Same thing.
All right. So a female prophet. Does anyone know what happened to the word actress? This is a legitimate question, believe it or not. This has bugged me for a couple of years now, and it really shouldn't, but it bugs me. We used to have actors and then actresses, right? Back in the day? Back in my day, I'll even say. And now, everybody's an actor, whether you're male or female. Are we just trying to get rid of the gender pronouns? Is that all it is? Okay. I mean, I know it's not policeman anymore, right? It's police officer, because you can be male or female, so policewoman apparently is degrading in some way. I'm not sure. But anyway, verse 20, it's a whole different rabbit that popped out, but prophetess, apparently she was not offended by the female form of the word prophet. I don't know what that's all about. Anyway, the sister of Aaron. Now, who is she also the sister of? Moses. Who wrote this book? Moses. Why in the world didn't Moses say, oh, my sister? Do you think? This is all conjecture. There's no wrong answer, but there kind of is. Why do you think? That's the one I was going to try to weasel my way through to get that answer. Man, there we go. Tom's pulling it through immediately. Any other thoughts or suggestions or ideas? It's interesting to me to see how people talk about themselves in Scripture. I say that because there are a few instances in which we have people of renown writing a book by inspiration that is preserved for us in the canon of Scripture, the rule of law which we have as the Bible, right? And so we've got someone in the New Testament, for example, named Jude. Also, Judas is the same idea there. He was somewhat significant by his blood relations. Who is he the half-brother of? Jesus. You think he might mention that in his little book. Oh, by the way, in case you're wondering who I am, I'm the half-brother of Jesus. But he didn't even say that. Who else is a half-brother of Jesus in the New Testament? James. These two guys are brothers, right? And they're half-brothers, technically, to Jesus. And not a single one of them mentions, oh yeah, by the way, I grew up with this guy we're writing about who's the savior of the world. I think that might be the first thing I would have said if it was me just talking because of non-inspiration. I was like, just so you know who I am, guys. I know it's been a little while, a couple of years, but remember who I am? I'm James, the half-brother of Jesus. So if anyone knows him, it's definitely me. Here's what he said and did. And here are some of the funny stories from me growing up with him. I mean, that would have been me, but of course, that's inspiration. Jim.
I thought it was interesting also in the book of John, that disciple whom Jesus loved was mentioned five times in the book of John.
Yeah. Well, who's that guy that Jesus loved?
He didn't love the Apostle John.
Well, yeah, it's got to be the Apostle John, right? Different individual. But he didn't say, the one that Jesus loved the most, by the way, that was me, John. You know, like, if you were best friends with the Son of God, wouldn't you think it come up when you're writing a book about him? But it's a form of humility, we assume, right? Because they're writing not just because of their own stories, but because they're inspired by the Spirit of God to pen these words that we're reading. And so when Moses here has the ability to introduce his sister Miriam and also Aaron, he doesn't talk about it as if it's kind of a family business. He's not saying, hey, look, I got my siblings together and here is the situation that we helped unfold unto the Israelites and we saved them through this means. It's never about Moses. It's never about Miriam. It's never about Aaron. It's all about God working through these people. And so the emphasis here is on Aaron, not on Moses. So interesting little nuance there. She took the timbrel in her hand. What's a timbrel? You say tambourine? That's what we always kind of see. A timbrel is one of those things that's an ancient instrument. There you go. Perfect description. Where, did it have strings? We don't know. Because the Hebrew word here is a little unclear. It's one of those instruments that's mentioned, especially in the book of Psalms. They say, hey, make sure you play this psalm in worship to God with this and this instrument. And we go, great. What were they? What's a shiganoff? Anybody know? No one knows what a shiganoff was, but we're supposed to play certain psalms if we were Jews on the shiganoff. So make sure you find one and then you go ahead and play it. Of course, the emphasis is not on the actual musical instrument. It's on the words that are spoken to God, interestingly. So she took the timbrel in her hand. We always kind of just have the image of a tambourine, which I guess is fine. But just kind of keep in the back of your mind, it may or may not be a tambourine. And all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dances. So all the ladies here are just overjoyed because they didn't get killed by the Egyptians. They weren't dragged back to be slaves. They were given the victory by God through the Red Sea, and they were somewhat happy about it, which is a good thing. Howard? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good thought. You come across a word in the book of Psalms, which is interesting. It's the word Selah. And I remember the first time I took a public speaking course in my high school, my senior year, as one of those courses to kind of, you know, have enough courses to make sure you get through. And they were always saying, well, why are you here? What is your purpose? What's your intent in taking this class? And absolutely everyone said, I needed a filler class. And then they got to me, and I was like, well, I'm going to be a preacher when I get out of this high school, so I'm going to try and learn something from you while I'm here. And the teacher was so blown away by that, he was like, all right, so you get to go first. It's like, oh. So he's like, I want you to figure out what kind of poem you want to present to the class. I'm like, poetry? Like, I'm a man. I don't read poetry. I don't have feelings. I don't have emotions. I'm made of nothing but mahogany and steel, right? So I'm like, all right, I've got to do a poem. I guess I'll read this book. I'm kind of interested in the Bible, and I'll figure out if there's a poem in there or not. And there are a few, believe it or not. And I found one that's technically kind of a poem when there's no music behind. I read a psalm to the class. And they didn't throw things at me, which was great. So yeah, we got plenty of time. All right, so I'll hear sometimes people say, like, you know what, you can't have a Bible in public school, you can't have a Bible in state school, you can't talk about it. You know, when I got converted, I carried a little Bible I was given around absolutely everywhere. Like, you had your little desk, you know, a small little cramped desk for a 6'2 guy. And I had a little pencil right there, and then I had something else, and I had like a book, and I had a Bible right here the whole time for the last 2 years in high school. If you want a conversation starter in high school, you live a sinful lifestyle that everyone knows about, and then you get converted, and then you bring a Bible and set it on your desk every single day. I mean, I would have thought that would have been a target on my back, but I can't believe how many people were overjoyed that I had changed from who I was to who I was at the end of high school, which is a wonderful thing. I didn't hear a single thing of grief from any teachers, any counselors. Everybody was okay with me being a quiet, boy in high school with the Bible, just minding my own business, learning about God. Everybody was okay with it. I'm not saying it's everyone's experience. I'm not saying it's going to be, you know, your children's experience, but it's just, I hear a lot about how negative things are when it comes to the Bible in public places, and I didn't have that experience at all. So anyway, I was in public speaking class, and I read a song. And I didn't know what this word Selah was all about at the end of certain lines in the book of Psalms. So I read the word Selah. So then like a year after I read this thing publicly, I realized, talk about comedians, there's one out there. Anyway, and I learned that that word Selah was just a rest or a pause or a beat. So we sometimes have pauses or rest or breaths in our songs. Same exact thing is there in Psalms. When we read it, it's just a break or a pause or a breath. And so the same thing Howard was saying, sometimes there's that break in a line or whatever, and they use an instrument to emphasize that. That could be what that word Selah is in the book of Psalms as well. Anyway, verse 21. And Miriam answered them, "Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea." We sometimes expect a little bit more out of Miriam when she finally opens her mouth and says something, but kind of short and sweet and to the point, right? Everybody's happy, everybody's overjoyed, and her great song of praise to God is just a factual statement about exactly what took place, right? So, not high poetry here, but it's one thing to kind of emphasize. Last time we saw her, she was saving her brother's life and allowing him to grow up in Pharaoh's household, being nursed by his own mother and being paid for it. Now we see her present at the Red Sea crossing. So she left, obviously, with the rest of the Israelites. She was there. She saw what took place. And she was rejoicing like everybody else. But she's mentioned specifically here. Okay, questions, comments? Y'all might have noticed that Keith D. just walked out a second ago. He heard laughter. And he's like, "My people need me. I must go tell jokes and make more laughter." That's what happened. When he gets back, you can tell him what I said. Because if you heard any of his comments ever on Sunday mornings before worship, he definitely deserves it. Okay, moving on. Numbers chapter 12. Now, we are fast-forwarding the VHS tape a lot here. We got a lot of squiggly white lines before we get to our next point. A lot of stuff takes place, and kind of wish we had time to go through it, but we went through a lot of it already, so I'm just going to have to fast forward here. Let's go to Numbers chapter 12. This one is kind of the most infamous one because of what takes place. Now, I'm not going to try to defend Aaron and Miriam really too much here in this text, but I will say if I were there and I was in Miriam or Aaron's shoes and I dealt with all the grief from the people that they dealt with over these years, it's definitely something to think about, what it would have been like. If great Miriam and great Aaron sunk to this kind of level, I really doubt I would do any better in this circumstance. So there's some backstory here, but we don't really have time to go into too much of it, so we'll just kind of jump right into it in verse 1. Numbers 12, verse 1. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses. What does that mean? He criticized him. All right. Well, he's not without fault. He's fallible. So they spoke against him, though, him being the authority figure that God has set up, the one through whom he was going to deliver the people and speak to them through his personhood. Welcome back, Keith. Yeah. So we see that Moses was the guy that God chose, right? That should be beyond doubt. God specifically chose Moses for reasons. We have some ideas of what those reasons may have been, but he was the one that God chose. And that makes sense, because God's going to choose the best person for each situation, each circumstance, to get his will accomplished, which is an interesting note for us, right? So anyway, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses, so they had a problem with him. And here was the problem. Because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married. Oh, in case you didn't know, because he married an Ethiopian woman. So it's kind of mentioned there along the side of what took place. we don't have much more detail about what this situation was, what the real problem was, what the contention was over, beyond us just supposing, well, he married someone that was not an Israelite, not from the stock of the people he was trying to save. It could be the case that she was married by Moses after his original wife had passed away, which took place earlier, or it could have been there was some kind of overlap there or whatever, but they were upset because he married an Ethiopian woman, and that led them towards the course of action of speaking against God's chosen Redeemer of Israel, which is not a good thing. Okay? Verse 2. Here is their speaking against him. Here is their line of reasoning. So they said, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses?" What's the answer to that question? No. God didn't exclusively speak only through Moses. Remember what Miriam's profession was, what her description was? A prophetess. So she had some experience in getting revelation from God. "Has he not spoken through us also?" And it says here, "And the Lord heard it," as if, you know, of course he's going to hear it. It's not like they can go anywhere where he's not going to hear what they're saying to each other, but it's just emphasized to us here, the Lord was paying attention to what they were saying and how they were saying it and who they were talking bad against. They were kind of in the back talking, you know what, why is Moses up there? Hasn't God worked through us and spoken through us? Why does he get to be the one that's out front all the time doing all these things? Aren't we useful? Of course we are. So why has he got to be the guy? Well, that's not a good thing to say. Now, verse 3, this is a little bit funny to me because you know my sense of humor a little bit, hopefully. Who wrote this book? Moses wrote the majority of it. There are some sections, especially towards the end, where it wouldn't be as possible as other places for him to write it. But here we are pretty conclusively set that Moses is the one that wrote these words, which, again, a little funny. Now, the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth. So you see the irony in someone who's called the most humble man on earth writing about himself, saying he's the most humble man on earth. I mean, you can't escape how funny that is. Keeping in mind here, these words that were written by Moses were not specifically chosen by him. If you do a longer study of inspiration of the Old and New Testament, you'll recognize that God doesn't just give them the thoughts and they write down whatever they're thinking about those thoughts. God chooses those words specifically. And so these words were, although they were written by Moses, they were not the words of Moses. And in fact, if he was the most humble guy in the world, then he wouldn't be writing about how humble he was. But it's mentioned here to us to give us some context about his personal character, which I'm thankful for. So you've got Moses out front. You got Aaron and Miriam here in the background kind of talking. Okay, anyway, sorry. I was distracted because there's a little peanut-looking baby who's not with her. So, now, the man Moses was very humble, more than all the men who were on the face of the earth. You see him writing this. You see him saying this. You see him living this. And then verse 4. "Suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, 'Come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting.'" This is one of those situations where, I mean, I've never had an experience like this, but I've had things that when someone says, "Look, we need to talk right now, come into my office," like, oh no. So here they are, Moses being the guy who's doing his best to lead these people and do what God wants. All of a sudden, God just says, "You three, come here now." It's like, okay, we're going to go to the tabernacle and talk to God real quick and see what he wants. So the three came out. And the Lord came down in the pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle. You get called into the principal's office, but the principal just happens to be your creator, maker, sustainer, redeemer, God himself. He says, "Come here." You come, and he just comes out of heaven for you real quick and goes to the door of the tabernacle of meeting and stands there. And you're like, oh no, what have we done? What's going on? And called Aaron and Miriam. Now, I wonder if Moses felt relief that he wasn't called as well, or if he was petrified because he did not want his siblings to die for whatever was going on. Yeah, you three, but then right here in verse 5, Aaron and Miriam were specifically called from those three. So he's now in the background, and they're called to the front. Notice the ironic positioning here. Moses is always out front, right? And they're always in the background. They want to be out front, and God pulled them out front. Yeah, I mean, they could have thought, hey, look, we asked for it, ask and you shall receive, right, guys? Verse 6, and then he said, hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, in case you forgot who I was, make myself known to him in a vision. Okay, let's pause. What God just did, it seems like, is saying, look, you guys think prophets are the emphasized thing here? You forget. If there's a prophet out there, who's the one that talks to him? Me. I'm in charge here. I speak through the prophet. Okay? I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant, Moses. He is faithful in all my house. You ever been called to a meeting where you thought you were going to get fired or get in trouble, and instead they give you some praise, and you don't know what to do? I've been called into a very serious meeting before where I got a promotion. I remember I was an intern for Gloucester County Public School System, which was interesting, with great learning experience. I'll say that. But I had a boss, Bill, and Bill was a good guy. I liked him a lot. He's a good boss. And I was paid minimum wage, which back then I can't, it was $6.25 maybe, is I think what it was. And I busted my tail trying to do the best I could because it was my first real paying gig that wasn't just cutting grass or raking leaves or whatever. And so Bill called me into a meeting one day. So I'm going, all right, Bill. So I came in there and I sat down. I'm ready to hear it. Think about all the things I've done in my whole life, things he might know about, things that maybe he figured out about or whatever. Like, I didn't know anything bad, but still, just those thoughts go through your mind. And he goes, look, I need to talk to you about something very serious. I go, okay, Bill, what's up? He goes, I see how you're working. I go, oh, no, my work ethic is not good enough. Like, I'm trying really hard. It's really hot out here. Like, what am I supposed to do? I'm moving computers all day long. And he was like, and I don't think minimum wage, and he paused, is enough for you. So I've talked to my boss, and we're going to give you a $2 promotion an hour. For my first paid internship for the county, I'm like, thank you so much. But that moment of pause, everything just stopped, and I thought I was going to die. Now, that was just Bill. That was just a little county internship. Here, God says, look, you two, if I want to talk, I talk through a prophet, right? Through a vision or through a dream. This guy right here, Moses, who's been with me the whole time, I just talk to this guy. He's faithful in all my house. I speak with him face to face, plainly, not in dark sayings. I don't have to veil my message because of fear. I just tell him what's going on. And he sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? Well, talk about a perspective changer. They were saying, Moses, our brother, he's not all that. God's talked to us before. Why has he always got to be the guy out front? They get called out front and says, look, if I want to talk to you people, I talk through him face to face. He sees my form. He knows me. I know him. What made you think it was okay to talk bad about him? He may be your brother. He's my servant. So we'll pause and make some proper application, shall we? There are people that do not fill the role of Moses specifically today in our world. We don't have a Moses-like human figure to which we could speak badly about in our church today. I suppose we could talk bad about Moses, but I'm sure he's beyond the point of caring now, right? So what are some other people that the Lord has specifically chosen to be in places of authority that we should think twice about before disrespecting? That's my application. Elders. They're the first one that comes to mind. The word elder, the word presbyter, is a transliteration of the Greek word. You've got shepherd, you've got overseer, you've got all these different words that describe this position that we just simply call an elder, right? Pastor as well as technically an elder, biblically speaking. And so God establishes these elders. It's not like we choose them, we just recognize that the Lord has chosen them to be elders because they meet the qualifications he has set forth. And therefore, when we have an eldership or an individual elder, there's a certain amount of respect just for the office, if not for the Christian man that takes time out of his life to help shepherd us. There's a certain level of respect that we ought to have. And you can go any direction you want to with that particular point. You can go with the idea of when they say we're going to assemble at a certain time to worship God, we ought to respect our elders and therefore be present, if we're at all possible, to worship God with the brethren at that point, because that's their charge. They're given the charge to feed us. And so when they say it's spiritual feeding time at this time and this time and this time, we ought to do all we can to show up for those meals because that's their responsibility and their obligation. So help them help you is the idea. And there's a lot of other areas in which elders have authority that we ought to respect for the individual as our brother in Christ, but also because of that position that God has established over the church. What's other areas that we should have respect for? Parents? Well, that one's tough. We don't really want to admit that, but technically speaking, biblically speaking, we ought to honor our father and mother. It seems to be a pretty consistent theme. Now, what that means through culture, what that means through age, what that means through a lot of different variables that we have in life does change. The respect you have for your parents as a five-year-old might be somewhat different than your respect for a parent who's 85 or 90 or 95, right? So there's a certain level of maturity and growth that goes along with it, but the consistent baseline for respect for your parents and that position of authority that God's established through the way that we are created is certainly there. Anything else? Hilton? Yeah, it's interesting what's emphasized and what's not about that relationship. It says, make sure you honor your father and mother as long as they deserve it. As long as they are good enough to you to deserve that love. Certainly, if we are commanded to love our enemies, we can love our parents, right? It shouldn't be the same level, ideally. Okay, so the application is there. You can see where we're going with this. God did not just let his point guy, Moses, take the hit for this. God himself thought it was significant enough for them to subvert his authority, his position, his power, to come down from heaven, talk to these two people and say, what made you think it was okay to talk bad about Moses? Whatever your reasoning was, not good enough. And so if they were thinking we were going to be justified by this action, that was not the case. And so the anger of the Lord was aroused against them, and he departed. He got so mad, he just left. I remember I had an instructor. Well, not yet. But he was mad, right? I had an instructor who imparted to us the wisdom of when you are in a situation where you're tempted to speak out of anger or rashness or vindictiveness or whatever the case, if it's not what you would do when you're level-headed, it's better to excuse yourself from that situation to calm down than just feel embarrassed and react out of that emotion. And he demonstrated that a couple of times with our preaching student fellows. He said, you know what? You've made me so mad. I'm going to walk away And when I come back, we'll talk about what you're going to do. And usually it was, you're going to go home and pack up your stuff and go back wherever you came from. That was his rational decision. Had a few times where that wasn't a rational decision, but he definitely made that point clear. All right, verse 10. When the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, as white as snow. All right, leprosy is one of those things in the Bible that we're kind of disconnected from, fortunately. Fortunately, we don't have to know what a leper colony looks like in this country, in this culture right now. They're still around, they still exist, but leprosy was no joke, to say the least. Miriam, prophetess, the individual who ensured the safety and the rescue of her little baby brother in Egypt all the way back then, was given the punishment of being a leper. It's harsh. She'd been through a lot. And this mistake that they made seemed to be somewhat small compared to other mistakes that were made by the other people. But she was in a position of authority. And we conclude from that that there is some implication that the Lord took that authority to the furthest extent. Anyway, then Aaron turned towards Miriam, and there she was, a leper. And so Aaron said to Moses, "Oh, my Lord, please do not lay this sin on us, in which we have done foolishly, in which we have sinned." He didn't make any qualms about it. He knew that what they did was sinful. That's the very first step to reconciliation, is the admission that sin took place. "Please not there let her be as one as dead, whose flesh is half consumed when he comes out of his mother's womb." And Moses cried out to the Lord, "Please heal her, O God, I pray." And the Lord said to Moses, "If her father had but spit in her face, would she not be shamed 7 days? Let her be shut out of the camp 7 days, and afterward she may be received again." So Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days. The people did not journey until Miriam was brought in again, and afterward the people moved from Hazeroth and camped in the woods of Paran. So the Lord relented against that punishment, because Aaron spoke up, admitted fault, and also Moses stepped up and interceded for her through prayer and says, "All right, I'll give you a week to live like this. That's the consequence, and then y'all can move on again." All right. The very last passage that we read about her is in Numbers chapter 20 and verse 1. We'll go ahead and read that quickly, and then we'll close our class out. "Then the people of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there." That's it. We say lesser-known people of the Bible for a good reason. We don't have anything else about her when it comes to the actual scriptures. We have traditional thoughts that have been passed down for many generations, but this is not in scripture. And so she's lesser known, but there were some significant moments where she was present and she did what she did, and we learned from those examples. So anyway, thank you very much for your attention this morning. We're going to begin our study of the book of Judges comprehensively next week, and we'll be dismissed now for about 15 minutes.